Deal or No Deal today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump says he saved 1,000 manufacturing jobs in Indiana, jobs that would have gone to Mexico. The local union leader is in the dark.
He said, I guess it's a good sign, but you would think they would have kept me in the loop. We know nothing.
Plus, Trump has said he'd scrap the nuclear deal with Iran. Here's what CIA Director John Brennan thinks about that.
I think it would be the height of folly if the next administration were to tear up that agreement.
And in Newton County, Georgia, Muslims announced plans to build a new mosque and cemetery. Some of their neighbors didn't like the idea.
I will have to admit that I was a little nervous about the future for Newton County.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being here. The threat of deportation looms large for many undocumented immigrants, especially with Donald Trump now set to become president. And the deportation process itself isn't always clear from a legal point of view. Today, the Supreme Court considered this question: does an immigrant who is detained and facing deportation have the right to a bond hearing? This doesn't just apply to the undocumented, by the way. Take the case of Arnold Giammarco, who was deported back to Italy a few years ago. His parents brought him to the United States from Italy when he was just 4 years old. He lived here in the U.S. as a legal permanent resident for about 50 years. 50. During that time, he served in the U.S. Army, got married, and had a daughter. But his life wasn't always on the straight and narrow. Giammarco stumbled into addiction, and a few years ago, he was arrested for stealing some power tools from the back of a truck. Then in 2011, officials with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, showed up at his door.
I was sitting on my front porch, and I seen three vehicles come up, unmarked police vehicles, to the housing complex. And I seen three officers come out, and they started running towards me. And as they got closer, they told me to put down the phone, to get on my belly, and to put my hands behind my back. They put handcuffs on me and they picked me up and they put me into the car and they drove me away. I told them what was going on. I'm planning on going to work another hour. Can you explain what's going on here? They pulled over on the side of the road and they told me I was going to get deported.
So you had been a legal permanent resident of the U.S. for about 50 years. What do you think it was about your past that made the authorities from ICE come and find you?
I had a larceny four back in 2006, and a 1 year suspended sentence they gave me. The crimes that I've committed, I already paid for, and I regret for doing that. And I have a wife and daughter to take care of.
You said larceny. What actually happened?
I did the stupidest thing in my whole life. Me and my wife and a friend of ours were in a parking lot. There was a truck there, a maintenance truck. The doors were open, and I took a couple of power tools, $600 worth of power tools. We got pulled over as soon as we left the parking lot, within 10 minutes, and they charged me with fourth-degree larceny. But that one-year suspended sentence is the one that got me deported.
So you were sent to a detention center once ICE picked you up. You spent 18 months there. What was that like?
A complete nightmare. The hardest part is being away from my wife and daughter. My daughter was 2 years old at the time, and watching my daughter behind a plain glass, I still remember her crying that she wanted me to hold her. She wanted me to play with her like I used to. Mm. You know, she still wanted me to tickle her. You know, her birthday, I missed again. It's tough. You know, she's a smart girl. She's a beautiful girl, but she doesn't have her father there with her.
Arnold, today you're kind of in a limbo as the Supreme Court hears arguments considering whether people like you have a right to a bond hearing. What would you like those justices to know?
If you have not committed a serious crime and you have family, a child needs a mother and father to grow up with, they have to give a bond hearing, you know? A six-month period, give a bond hearing within that time period, they could go out there, they could work, they could still support their family, they could still contribute to the community. But being detained and being in the cell block 24 hours a day, doing absolutely nothing, waiting for a plane ticket, give the person a bond hearing, listen to the story, and then make these decisions from there. I am an American. I fought for my country. I will fight for my country, which I highly respect.
I find it kind of striking that we're speaking to you. You're in Italy, and I think a lot of people think of deportees as people who come to the U.S. from south of the border, get detained, and get sent home, when in fact this happens to people from all over the world who end up here for one reason or another. What do you want Americans to understand about the facts of deportation?
To me, it took my heart from me. You know, it's my wife and daughter. They're the American citizens. And they are the ones that are suffering. I'm here in this little town with 290 people population here. I'm not doing nothing here. There's no jobs for me here. I can't speak the language. A daughter or a son needs to have a mother or father with them. That's what makes America so great, the dreams that everybody has. So give somebody a dream. Give them a bond hearing. Give them their respect.
Arnold Giammarco lived in the U.S. for more than 50 years as a legal permanent resident. He was deported to Italy and now lives in Campo di Fano, which is where he's been speaking with us from. Arnold, thank you very much for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you.
It's hard to say how Arnold's case will get sorted once Donald Trump steps into the White House. We have seen one Trump campaign promise materialize in the last day. During the presidential campaign, Trump often said he'd stop American companies from sending jobs out of the country. One of his favorite examples was Carrier, which has factories in Indiana that make furnaces. Carrier was planning to shift about 2,000 jobs to Mexico. Trump gave a 100% guarantee on the campaign trail that he'd stop that. Well, Trump appears to be making good, sort of, on his promise. In a tweet last night, he said the jobs were staying. The World's Jason Margolis was just in Indiana and has been covering this. What do we know, Jason, about the deal Trump struck with Carrier? What did he say? What could he offer as a president-elect?
Well, at this point, we know very little. As you said, there is a tweet, and Carrier came out with a tweet confirming what Trump said. That's really all we know.
Are all the jobs being saved or just some of them?
Some jobs are staying. So Carrier is owned by United Technologies. And they actually have two factories in Indiana. So combined, they have about 2,100 employees. Carrier now says it will keep about 1,000 jobs in Indianapolis. So it looks like about half of the jobs are staying in the U.S.
What is in this for Carrier?
That's the big question, right? So the move to Mexico was expected to save the company about $65 million a year. And one of the speculations is that the state of Indiana will give Carrier incentives to stay put. And remember who the governor of Indiana is, right? It's Mike Pence. So he still is the governor. And another speculation is that Trump got tough with United Technologies. About 10% of that company's business comes from defense contracts. So Trump might have threatened to pull some of the contracts. Or maybe Trump made broad policy promises, things like lower taxes, cutting regulations. We don't know. But and then there was one last thing. It's good PR for Carrier. The price the company will pay is about $65 million again, and that's tiny compared to what they make. The company reported $56 billion in sales last year and $4 billion in profit.
How are the Carrier workers in Indiana reacting to this news?
So I reached out to some people I met in Indiana today. Mike Fugate is a Democrat turned Trump supporter. He told me via email that he's, quote, good right now, waiting to see the deal done. Paul Roll, he's also a Trump supporter, said he was, quote, shocked and in disbelief when he found out. And then there's Chuck Jones, who's the president of the local union there. He was a Hillary Clinton supporter. He said he was optimistic today, but he doesn't know what the situation is. He said, I guess it's a good sign, but you would think they would have kept me in the loop.
I'm just curious, what kind of wages do these jobs pay?
Generally about $20 to $25 an hour. I met one guy who makes $23.83 an hour, and that's a pretty good wage for Indiana. He told me that if he were to lose his job, he would have to find a service sector job and have to work two jobs to make that wage. Just by sense of comparison, an Indiana worker makes the same in an hour as someone in Mexico would make in a day.
I know we don't have a lot of details, but is the kind of intervention we saw with Donald Trump and Carrier sustainable over the long run?
No. I mean, the short answer is no.
Why not?
Well, economists are coming out very strongly against the Carrier deal. Justin Wolfers, who's an economist at the University of Michigan, tweeted, quote, every savvy CEO will now threaten to ship jobs to Mexico and demand a payment to stay. Great economic policy. Mike Hicks, who's an economist at Ball State in Muncie, Indiana, told me, for every manufacturing job lost to trade, factories lose between 5 and 9 to machines. Nothing in this announcement will change that. So, I mean, the bottom line is it's a great PR move for Donald Trump. But let me just leave you with one last thought. Back in 2009, the Republicans savaged the stimulus package from the Obama administration and how they saved General Motors. And Mike Pence, who was a congressman at the time, stood on the House floor and he said, quote, Republicans oppose this bill because this backroom deal is simply a long wish list of government spending that won't put Americans back to work. So I guess the take home is it's a bad policy when your opponent does it, and it's a smart policy when you do it.
The World's Jason Margolis, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Marco.
The city of Copenhagen is known as a place where bicycles rule, but now they really rule because last month, Copenhagen reached a milestone. More people now ride their bikes to the city's downtown than drive. Now, this didn't happen by magic or public goodwill. How the city reached this milestone actually could be a model for other cities to follow as traffic and population increase. Morten Kabel is the head of transit for the city of Copenhagen. When you heard this news, what did you think?
I was very happy, obviously. On the other hand, it confirmed what we sort of already know in Copenhagen, that if you build it, people will use it. If you build the infrastructure, then people will actually start using it. And that's what we have been doing for the last decades in Copenhagen, building a sustainable infrastructure, building a solid network of bicycle lanes and bicycle routes throughout the city. And that has now made results.
So a decade ago, Morten, did you kind of set out as a goal to have more bikes and cars in the city center and then figured out how to reach that goal?
Basically, what we set out was the goal of at least 50% of all commuting should be done by bicycle in 2025. Today, we've reached 40-something percent, and that's good. So we're on our way. But this goal that I actually hadn't thought of would happen so soon, of more bikes downtown than cars. We hadn't seen that coming, I should be honest to say, but I'm very happy about it.
What was the cost of all this? Because we're talking bridges and other serious infrastructure all devoted to bicycles.
Well, it's probably the cheapest infrastructure you can actually build.
I mean,
10 years of investments in a bicycle infrastructure in Copenhagen is the same as we have built in one single bypass for cars in the north of Copenhagen. So basically, bicycle infrastructure is the cheapest infrastructure you can build.
Now, I know the news is pretty fresh, but have you been able to learn anything about the payoffs from this, like reduction in noise pollution or air pollution, even like asthma and overall health?
There is no doubt for us that we can see the co-benefits of this. From having a healthier population, people staying fit longer, to a reduction of the deaths or serious illnesses. So we can see a lot of co-benefits, and we can measure them. And by all instances, the co-benefits are huge.
So I've been to Copenhagen. It's not too dissimilar from a lot of American cities, wide streets, mix of commercial and residential. Make the case to our mayors here, like our mayor here in Boston, that this can happen and should happen in other cities.
Well, this should happen. If you really want to promote local shopping, if you want to promote liveliness in the streets, then you should actually promote a bicycle infrastructure because bicycle riders shop locally. And there is also a sense of safety. If in a city you actually want safe streets, if you want to feel safe, then you need to meet people eye to eye. You don't want to just look at a metal box. You want to look at a person. And you do that when you are actually riding your bicycle or when other people are riding your bicycle. Then you can see them. Then you know who you're dealing with. That feels a lot safer than just coping with a metal box on wheels.
Do you envision a day when there are zero cars in Copenhagen city center?
No. There'll always be cars. We have people with handicaps that need to have a car. You need goods being delivered to shops and to supermarkets. So obviously we will always have cars. The only difference is how many cars will we have? And can we actually create a city where we have the greenest possible transport solution and thereby having much more bicycles than we have cars? Yes, I believe that. And we are that way in Copenhagen.
Morten Kabel, the head of transit for the city of Copenhagen. Thanks very much and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
A dome for Chernobyl. That's next on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I want to take you back now about 30 years to this news bulletin from Eastern Europe.
The Soviet government reports an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine. Measures are being taken to deal with the aftermath of the accident and to help those affected.
The Chernobyl disaster in April 1986 turned out to be the worst nuclear meltdown in history. It spewed radiation across Ukraine and much of Europe. And to this day, a 20-mile no-go zone exists around the plant. But this week, a huge new shield was moved into position over the accident site. My BBC colleague Tom Burridge was there and saw it.
It's steel and concrete. It weighs more than the Eiffel Tower in Paris, for example.
Wow.
So it's absolutely massive. They've moved it using an intricate system of hydraulic jacks so that it sits over reactor 4, where that accident was back in 1986.
Very impressive and a great achievement of engineering, but why is it needed? I mean, 30 years later, how dangerous is the area still?
Yeah, well, basically, in the wake of the disaster back in April 1986, when there was an explosion, then a fire, 3% of the radioactive material inside the nuclear reactor actually escaped into the environment. So that leaves roughly 97% of it still inside reactor 4 today. Basically, in the wake of the disaster, they built very quickly a structure to go over the reactor and the huge amount of radioactive material inside. And therefore, they need this giant shield over the top so that the engineers can work underneath it to deconstruct the old reactor and to make the huge amount of radioactive material still inside safe.
I mean, just 30 years later, I mean, the presence and publicity of this dome, how worried are people in the region that maybe there was something they weren't told?
Well, I don't think they are. I mean, you know, there is this 30-kilometer exclusion zone around Chernobyl. You can go there as a tourist. It's pretty impressive. There's this ghost city just round the corner from the nuclear plant called Pripyat, and it's these huge Soviet concrete buildings. It was where the workers and their families lived. The families and their workers were evacuated in a hurry in the wake of the disaster. It is just left almost as it was, and now in sort of ruins, but it's a pretty impressive sight. So tourists can go there. There is this exclusion zone, though, so it's tightly controlled. You have to get the right paperwork in order. But people can come and go. And the workers, of course, working on this huge, giant shield, and the workers who will now begin work underneath it to secure the actual reactor, I mean, they've been coming and going from the site throughout. So people are going there on a daily basis. The workers, though, do work shift patterns, so they'll work 15 days on and 15 days off. The thinking is that, you know, during the 15 days of work, they will be exposed to higher levels of radiation than normal, of course, and therefore they need 15 days off to give their bodies a rest from it.
What did it feel like to be at Chernobyl 30 years after the disaster?
Well, it's a strange place. It's slightly eerie. That ghost city is a funny place to go, but it's fascinating. It, of course, was a disaster, so it's not a sort of particularly happy sort of moment of history to kind of go back to and learn about. But at the same time, it was such a major event. You know, the Soviet authorities' reaction that we heard snippet of, you know, the way they covered it up, the way they mismanaged it, it did contribute to the downfall of the Soviet Union. It sped up the fall of the Soviet Union in most people's opinions. So it's a major event of history, and therefore it's a fascinating place to visit.
My BBC colleague Tom Burridge, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Chernobyl is in northern Ukraine. We're going to shift east now to Ukraine's neighbor, Russia. Many Ukrainians have settled in Russia over the past 2 years. These are people who fled the fighting in eastern Ukraine, where Russian-backed rebels are engaged in a separatist campaign. Now many Ukrainians in Russia are in limbo, as Levi Bridges reports from Moscow.
It's Sunday afternoon, and 31-year-old Alla Levchenko is having tea with her older sister in a Moscow suburb. They're looking at pictures on a cell phone of Levchenko's home in Donetsk. That's the rebel stronghold in eastern Ukraine. Bombed-out buildings appear on the screen. Both sisters are ethnically Russian, but Levchenko was born in Ukraine. Her older sister, Yulia Privedenaya, was born here in Russia. When war broke out in Ukraine, Privedenaya told her younger sister to come to Moscow.
We would talk to each other on Skype, and you could hear the sounds of guns in the distance. So we made plans for them to leave, because it was clear this wasn't going to stop anytime soon.
About a million Ukrainians fled to Russia after the war started. But processing asylum applications has been slow, and only a third have received temporary asylum. That's left perhaps hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians in a situation similar to Levchenko, living at her sister's place in Russia with a temporary permit. That doesn't allow her to work, though. So she took a job off the books at a small store outside of Moscow. Levchenko sums up how she's working with one word.
Неофициально. Нелегально.
Нелегально. Illegally. Левченко says she never imagined that life in Russia would be this tough. When war first broke out in Ukraine, Moscow said it would help Ukrainians coming to Russia. Back then, Russia set up hundreds of what were called temporary accommodation centers to host Ukrainian migrants, but the government then quickly shut most of them down. I made repeated interview requests to the Russian Interior Ministry. They sent a brief response basically saying the government is supporting Ukrainian migrants, but refused to address any specific questions. Marina Lexina, a social worker with the nonprofit Civic Assistance Committee in Moscow, says the government's promises to resettle Ukrainians are simply propaganda.
To show the world, to show the international community that, look, we're doing a good job here. Look how many people gain protection. Look how many people gain the path to citizenship.
She says many Ukrainians can't even begin the application process for asylum in Russia. Applicants first need to find a Russian citizen willing to register them. But more than several hundred thousand Ukrainians haven't found anyone here to do that. In the nearby city of Obninsk, a volunteer makes photocopies of a Ukrainian passport in the bottom floor of a Soviet-era apartment. More than 1,000 Ukrainians have come here seeking Tatiana Kutlar's help. She's a member of the regional legislature. Kutlar is registering Ukrainians to her own apartment's address. Without her, she says they'd have to buy expensive documents from corrupt officials.
Представьте себе, что вы приехали с семьей, с родителями, с тремя маленькими детьми и прочее.
Imagine that you come here with your family and your kids. You need money for food and rent. Winter is coming and you don't have clothes. You didn't bring any warm clothes because you were running away in a hurry. You won't have money to buy registration documents on top of everything else.
But registering foreigners to houses or apartments where they don't physically live is illegal. And investigators have opened a criminal case against Kutlar for doing this. Back in Moscow, Alla Levchenko, that's the younger sister who fled Ukraine, worries that she also might get in trouble because she doesn't have a work permit. Her older sister, Yulia Prividenaya, feels frustrated by the Russian immigration system.
Our country doesn't even have to support refugees financially. Russia just needs to give them the opportunity to legally be here.
Because going back home just isn't an option. So for now, most ethnic Russians who fled Ukraine will have to survive by working illegally in Russia. For The World, Levi Bridges, Moscow.
Headlines are next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the lawyer who fought for the release of memos that justified the Obama administration's use of drones.
They created an entire bureaucracy to regularize the practice of targeted killing. And you could see that as a positive thing or an extremely chilling thing.
Questioning the president's power to kill, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President-elect Donald Trump doesn't like the nuclear deal with Iran, the one negotiated by the Obama administration to reduce Iran's nuclear capabilities in exchange for sanctions relief. Trump's been railing against the deal from the moment he announced his candidacy last year.
And we won't be using a man like Secretary Kerry that has absolutely no concept of negotiation, who's making a horrible and laughable deal.
That's what Trump had to say in June 2015 about Secretary of State John Kerry, who led the U.S. negotiating team on the Iran deal. Since then, Trump has said he'll tear up the nuclear agreement with Iran as soon as he's in office. Here's what outgoing CIA Director John Brennan has to say about that.
I think it would be the height of folly if the next administration were to tear up that agreement.
Brennan was speaking in an interview with the BBC's Gordon Carrera, who joins me now. So explain a little more what he told you, Gordon, about the Iran nuclear deal.
Well, he said it would be disastrous to tear up that deal, the height of folly, pretty strong language, basically arguing that it would be unprecedented for one administration to tear up a deal like that, especially one negotiated with international partners, that it would strengthen the hardliners in Iran and potentially push Iran towards developing nuclear weapons, which might then in turn lead other countries in the region to do the same and to follow, and so make the region more dangerous. Obviously, there are a lot of people in Washington who disagree with that view, but John Brennan was pretty forceful in expressing his view that tearing up the deal would be a mistake.
Yeah, it was actually interesting when Brennan said that Trump would be the first president to terminate an agreement that had already been struck by his predecessor. How did he elaborate on that?
He didn't elaborate in too much more detail about that. I mean, obviously, presidents change policies from previous presidents. That's normal. But the idea of an internationally negotiated deal like this being torn up by one president, I think, is what he was indicating would be very different. And actually, allies who have been involved in that deal, for instance, the UK, have been saying today that they are still fully committed to it. So I think you can get that sense that the kind of establishment, as it were, on foreign policy and security internationally are still behind the deal, but they know that there are a number of people in Washington, not just Donald Trump, who are critical of that deal, including people in Congress, and who would like to get rid of it.
Mm. Donald Trump has nominated Mike Pompeo to fill in Brennan's current job. What's his position on the Iran nuclear deal?
He has been one of those critics of the deal, and he's, like Donald Trump, talked about getting rid of the deal. So I think what really struck me in the interview with John Brennan was the sense of uncertainty about what direction the incoming administration would take. I think he was indicating that he was not sure how far they would take advice, how far their positions in office would be the same as the positions they staked out at the campaign trail. At one point, when I asked him, did he think that they would take his advice or that they would shift their position, he simply said, I don't know, I don't know.
Mm. Now, I mean, one thing that a lot of critics have pointed out about the Iran nuclear deal are the sunset provisions that would allow Iran in a decade to restart uranium enrichment activities again. If that is a problem for Donald Trump, what does John Brennan think he should do if he's bothered by those provisions?
Well, we didn't get that kind of detail from John Brennan. I think the issue, though, will be if Donald Trump starts in his negotiation position from, I want to tear up this deal, is there a way he thinks he can reformulate it and change it to deal with some of those concerns? And we've seen that that's perhaps one strategy that Donald Trump might take on a number of issues. However, I think with the Iran nuclear deal, it was so tough to agree, and it remains quite divisive even within Iran between the hardliners and the moderates, and you have all these other countries involved in coming to that deal, that makes it, I think, going to be quite challenging to deal with some of those specific concerns and try and renegotiate certain parts of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because there are five other countries that signed on to this deal: Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, in addition to the US and Iran. If the US backs out, where does this leave the other signatories?
Well, I think it was very noticeable today that when the British government, the Prime Minister's spokesperson, was asked about this deal, they briefed very heavily that they were still fully committed to it, still fully committed to implement it. They said that national security advisers from the UK will be coming out to Washington in the next month to discuss, you know, amongst other things, this deal. And so I think you will see some of the other countries start to lobby Washington about it and the incoming administration. But of course, they've got to work out who to talk to. And I think a lot may depend until we find out who's Secretary of State and get that feel for who the key figures are in the administration. I think we are still, until then, in a position of uncertainty.
Our colleague at the BBC, Gordon Carrera, their security correspondent, thanks very much.
Thank you.
One defining feature of the U.S. response to 9/11 has been the use of armed drones to kill terrorism suspects. The strikes began under President George W. Bush and increased significantly under President Obama. Former ACLU lawyer Jamil Jaffer worked on key cases challenging the secrecy of the drone program, especially when it came to the legality of the president ordering the targeting and killing of an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki. But the cases were dismissed.
You know, the courts were presented with this question: do you have a role to play when the executive branch carries out the targeted killing of an American citizen? And the court said no.
Over time, though, pressure for accountability did lead to some action, not by the courts, but by the Obama administration. It drew up a set of more restrictive rules for itself to try to ensure accuracy and avoid civilian casualties.
They created an entire bureaucracy to regularize the practice of targeted killing. And, you know, depending on your vantage point, you could see that as a positive thing or an extremely chilling thing.
Attorney Jamil Jaffer led the fight to uncover and declassify documents related to the drone program, and he's collected them in a new book called The Drone Memos.
these very detailed documents about who's making what decisions. It makes clear that there are hundreds of people involved in this practice of targeted killing. And you look at those documents and you realize immediately that this is a practice that we really have institutionalized and entrenched and normalized. And, you know, there was a time when the United States would have characterized many of these killings as extrajudicial killings, as unlawful, even as assassinations. The United States prosecuted Chilean agents who carried out a targeted killing in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s. Mm. Everybody was outraged by Russia's killing of a former Russian government employee in London a few years ago. You know, the line between what the United States is doing in all of these countries and what it has previously characterized as assassination is not obvious.
Have you ever had the chance to talk to Obama about drones?
I haven't.
Would you like to talk to him about it?
I guess I would. I think that President Obama has been a great president in many, many different ways. And I think that the United States is a more humane and a more just place now than it was when he took office. But I think that the decisions that his administration made around this set of policies and more generally, I think, around national security policies were short-sighted. You know, they claimed a lot of power and then fought very hard to insulate that power from oversight by the judiciary, by Congress, by the public. And I think that Americans let them claim that power because at some level, Americans trusted President Obama. We invested powers in the presidency because we trusted the president. But the powers you invest in the presidency are then available to the next president and the president after that one.
Well, let me ask you about that. With Obama laying out these more restrictive rules, what happens to those rules under Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to recognize about the rules that the Obama administration is following on drones is that they were written by the Obama administration and can be swept away very easily by the next administration. That's the problem with having one branch alone make these, you know, develop these policies. So there is, you know, the presidential policy guidance that President Obama put in place in May of 2013. That's still the legal and policy framework for the drone campaign today. But there's nothing stopping President Trump from rescinding that guidance and replacing it with something else. But you know, you can't lay it on all of it on the at the feet of the Obama administration, and I don't. At the end of the day, it's not the executive branch's job to police itself. The courts and Congress had opportunities to play the role that the Constitution envisioned for them, and they didn't play that role. So I see the current landscape as a testament to the failure of all three branches.
Jamil, has this research taken a toll on you?
I'm sure it has. I'm sure it has. I guess I'll say that I'm grateful to have had the chance to make a case. And, I'm glad I had that chance, even though I didn't always prevail.
Jamil Jaffer, the director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's been over a year since the attacks in Paris. And since then, there's been a lot of talk in France about the country's failure to integrate many first and second generation immigrants. One part of the debate is about opening new economic opportunities for large numbers of young French Muslims. It's not a new debate in France, but it's taken on more urgency. Emma Jacobs took a closer look at one effort to improve opportunities by getting more diversity at some of France's elite universities.
This campus of Sciences Politiques, or Sciences Po, is located in an old Jesuit college in the city of Reims. The corridors have stone walls and exposed wooden beams with traces of really old paintings. But Mamadou Sissoko's favorite place on campus is the old library. We have to whisper in here.
It's an old library of Jesuits.
Every inch of the walls is covered in the dark wooden shelves or ornamental carvings.
Did you do your homework yet?
Yeah.
The odds were stacked against Sissoko's ever entering this elite university. He was born in Mali and moved to a Paris suburb at age 7.
Je ne savais pas ce que c'était Sciences Po jusqu'à la terminale.
I didn't know what Sciences Po was, he says, until the last year of high school, because they didn't talk about it. Sciences Po is one of France's most prestigious universities, the Grandes Écoles. To get in, students normally have to pass a highly competitive entrance exam. But Sissoko came in through an alternative admissions program called CEP. That's an acronym. Instead of taking the test, he did a research project and presented it to a panel. He shows his paper to me. It's on the Chinese stock market crisis that took place not long ago. This alternative path is open to students like Sissoko, who come from 106 high schools located in disadvantaged neighborhoods.
Oui, le programme il est né d'un premier constat.
Hakim Alouche, who runs CEP at Sciences Po, says it was born out of the observation that low-income students were underrepresented at France's most selective universities. CEP was also inspired by American-style affirmative action. But the Sciences Po version is different because in France, singling out one ethnic or racial group is considered un-French.
In the French Constitution, it's written that there shouldn't be any kind of discrimination on the basis of race, ethnicity. That's the idea that even positive discrimination is a form of discrimination.
Agnès Van Zanten is a sociologist at Sciences Po who studies education and inequality. She says there was some language early on the CEP webpage about achieving racial and ethnic diversity, but not for long.
Very rapidly disappear from the website. I think the idea was not to put too much emphasis on affirmative action. It would have given way to a very heated debate.
So they created this program based on geography. There was plenty of opposition at the start. Some people said it would devalue a Sciences Po diploma by lowering entry standards. Hakim Alouche was actually a member of the first CEP class. This is a video of him as a student taking part in a debate on French TV with another student, Laurent Manjol, who opposed CEP, and actually called the program dangerous.
Et dangereuse à plusieurs égards, et principalement parce qu'elle introduit.
Because, he said, it introduced quotas to French higher education, contrary to all French tradition. There actually aren't quotas, and the program is now much more well-established. Around 1,600 students have been admitted since 2001.
L'idée, c'est rentré dans les mentalités, en fait, le fait que...
Current CEP student Cyrine Bidou thinks it's part of the mentality now, the fact that Sciences Po opens its doors to students from working-class neighborhoods. She says she much prefers this model to affirmative action because she thinks it's less stigmatizing and more effective in reaching disadvantaged students. But critics say it's complicated. Even though it actually has made Sciences Po more ethnically diverse, CEP tends to favor the higher-income students in these disadvantaged high schools. This is sociologist Van Zanten.
We have observed that the people who have been profiting from the policy are not necessarily those more in need. 40% more or less of students who come from Sciences Po through these partnerships are not from lower class backgrounds.
She thinks it's great to try to diversify elite institutions, but she also worries that educational policies in France are increasingly focused on rescuing the best students from poor neighborhoods, rather than trying to help them all. As CEP student Mamadou Sissoko points out, there's more to be done to expand opportunities for other friends from his old neighborhood. We've shown the world that we can succeed, he says, but also that there are others behind us. We need to do more to help even more people. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
Our next story is about a plan to build a new cemetery. Shouldn't be too controversial, but apparently it is when the graveyard is for Muslims. This one would be about 35 miles outside of Atlanta, Georgia, in a semi-rural area, and it's been met with some fierce resistance, even before the election of Donald Trump, who's talked at times about barring Muslims from entering the U.S. From The World's Religion Desk, here's Matthew Bell.
The town square in Covington, Georgia, with its quaint village green and the old clock tower, is a southern gem. And tonight, it's all decked out in its holiday best. A few months ago, this was a very different scene. Covington was in the national spotlight because the leaders of an Islamic center outside of Atlanta had bought a piece of land here. They planned to build on it, and lots of folks in Newton County were not happy.
Hundreds gathered at the courthouse in Covington Monday evening to argue for and against Muslims building a mosque in a cemetery.
I don't trust them. I don't trust this thing coming. And I have nobody knows what's really going on. How do we know it's not an ISIS camp, training camp?
That was back in August, not long after Keith Ellis says he got wind of the plans. Ellis is the chairman of the Board of Commissioners in Newton County. He says at first people reacted out of fear of a religion that they only really know about from TV.
As a Christian, I probably reacted in some of the same ways. I will have to admit that I was a little nervous about the future for Newton County.
When protesters showed up in the village green with assault rifles and anti-Muslim signs, Ellis and his fellow commissioners imposed a temporary moratorium on all religious building projects. Looking back on that decision, Ellis says it was not a real solution.
We recently had a church apply for permits. It's a Christian church. And during that time, they had to wait. So the moratorium affected them.
Probably weren't very happy about it.
Some of my Baptist friends were pretty upset with me. I got a few phone calls. The moratorium was lifted, and now they're back on schedule. So I don't think any of us want to get in the business of rewriting the Constitution.
On the northeast side of Atlanta, Muslim worshippers attend Friday prayers. The imam here is Muhammad Islam. He's 50 years old and not particularly tall, but he warns me that he can hold his own on the basketball court. Islam was born and raised in Bangladesh. He opened this mosque in 2005. The congregation has grown to about 1,000 people, and Islam says there's a real need for a Muslim cemetery and an Islamic body preparation facility. That's the biggest reason he decided to buy 135 acres of land in a rural part of Newton County. I ask if the negative reaction from so many people makes him feel unwelcome now.
I always feel that that I'm not alone. That's my faith, that my God is always with me. And Quran, my scriptures, teaches me that as long as you don't violate the basics of the code of the God, then you'll be always protected.
Islam says his long-term goal is to build a new mosque on that piece of land, a religious school, along with a park and a little organic farm. But for now, he's holding off, even though the legal path is clear for the project to move forward, and some members of his congregation want to get things started. Islam says it's more important to wait until temperatures have cooled.
Our property ends right here in the intersection.
Islam takes me on a drive past his land. There's a Baptist church across the street and a few houses nearby, but it's very much in the country.
If you can slow down, this is the right side. We can. This is the flag. We just put it in there.
You put the flag?
Yeah, I did.
You put the American flag?
Yeah.
Okay.
The people, they don't trust. That they say that we are against the, you know, the America. So they say we want to make sure that, you know, we show that we love America.
Islam seems pretty easygoing, but he admits to me later that the whole controversy kind of sent his blood pressure through the roof. And he says he could have done things differently. He could have done more community outreach and maybe avoided some of the more intense public reaction to the building project. The imam is reaching out to other people of faith to help with public relations. He has visited area churches and plans to hold an open house at his mosque. And he's connected with people like Lynn Pace, a United Methodist minister and the chaplain at Oxford College of Emory University.
For me, as a Christian, is exactly the kind of responsibility Jesus calls me to. Community is a place where we are responsible for one another.
Sometimes this can feel like an uphill struggle, Pace says, especially since Election Day.
But that doesn't mean we stop. For me, it's the call from Jesus, and that life that I try to emulate, it also speaks to the religious freedom that's been prized in this country from its outset. And then it's the experience I've had with people we might say are the other.
Last weekend, there was another small protest against the mosque project. But some Christian friends of Imam Muhammad showed up as well to hold a counter-protest and to speak up for their Muslim neighbors. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Covington, Georgia.
The house of worship for the Paris-based electronic duo Acid Arab is the dance floor. That may be sacrilegious for some people, but to Guido Minici and Hervé Cavallo, who are Acid Arab, the nightclub is where they hope body and soul are transported to a higher plane. And to help clubbers get there, Acid Arab turns to musicians like legendary Algerian rocker Rachid Taha. If this trip with Rachid Taha isn't your cup of tea, don't despair. Acid Arab provides many other ways to attain musical enlightenment. The path we'll take to the end of today's show is their collaboration with singer Sofiane Saidi. Here's their song, La Hafla. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow. كيندير نشوفك راكي طولي يا ماما ويا ماما شاطرة كيف الخرجات حواس المضويات يا ماما ويا ماما شاطرة كيف الخرجات حواس المضويات يا فاطمة بنت الجار وديري نصية وحنا من السيرك راني كولي زاد عليا الهم والحمالية كيندير نشوفك راكي طولي يا ماما ويا ماما شاطرة كيف الخرجات حواس المضويات يا ماما ويا ماما شاطرة كيف الخرجات حواس المضويات
RI, Public Radio International.